Overdrive continuing on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and also on TSN 4. Mark Rowe in for Brian Hayes. Brian is back next week. I'm joined by Mike Johnson. Mike is breaking it all down. Curling, baseball, hockey. We haven't even gotten to enough tennis, probably, which is really your expertise.
No.
You know, Rafa is playing in Madrid.
How about our boy Sasha Zverev? We haven't spoken about him.
Yeah.
That was some poor form by him. That whole tour out there in Serbia with Djokovic was poorly done. But then for him to say he's going to go in quarantine for 4 days, and then 3 days later he's at a massively busy bar morning brunch party dancing on a table.
Yeah, in Monte Carlo,
not
I
a
think.
Good look.
Yeah, it was
not
a
good.
It was a
yeah. The I'm optics. Happy he's having a good time, just not the time of the time in the world to be doing it.
But I wonder, you know, the difference between an athlete that plays an individual sport to a team. Like an individual athlete, it's not to say they're all arrogant, selfish athletes or people in general, but their whole life has been about them. It has to be. Like there's no way you can get to that level without it.
That's not a bad thing.
And it's not a bad thing, but... And as a hockey player or baseball player, there's an element to that, but you've always had to buy into a team. You've always had to, you know, do what's right for the man or the woman next to you in the locker room, on the ice, on the court. And so I think there is like a dose of reality there that they're just not used to. That it's like, hey, like I know that you're healthy and you feel like you can party and you can kill this virus, but like the rest of the world, and you could be asymptomatic and you could be giving it to other people.
It's a very good point. It's a very good point. They are used to kind of operating in their own orbit and answer to themselves, because if they do well or do poorly, it's on them. They reap the rewards or they pay the price depending on what happens with their sport. So that is, there is something maybe to that as well. But I did read that David Ferrer was going to work with them a little bit. So you want to talk about some penance he's going to have to pay with that little bulldog on the court. He will be doing some running to see if he's committed to playing with David Ferrer as his new coach. So we'll see how that shakes out through the summer, and then heading into even the U.S. Open. We were talking about you briefly. It's not that far away. It's only 7 weeks away.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, guys have to start figuring out their schedules as far as preparing to whatever they plan on doing in the fall.
Right. And they, in a way, have a bit of a hub where they're playing at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center in Queens.
Yes.
But unlike, you know, a lot of times players would be playing in or staying in hotels in Manhattan. A lot of times we would see some of those players, or they'd rent a house. Everyone's staying at, at a hotel by JFK Airport. You're going back and forth. You're there weeks before the U.S. Open. Some players will play in the Cincinnati event that's in New York. So it's 7 weeks away, but really for
Cincinnati event in New York.
In New York.
Interesting.
Cincinnati has always wanted to be in New York, and now they get to be it. So, you know, and if you talk to a tennis player, like the preparation for going to that event starts right around now. Like you're getting your body ready, especially if you're playing those two events. So it's, you know, it's these are.
And you just wonder, I mean, will the enormity of the U.S. Open, it's a major. It's U.S. Open, and that's really, really important. Is the negative part of the risk of coming to the States, of having a quarantine, of having to maybe live in a hotel by JFK? I'm sure there's some nice ones. I don't know, but probably not as nice as some of the ones in Manhattan, or renting a fancy house or whatever some of the top players play or stay when they go there. I wonder if the idea of like a month in that hotel is appealing to those players, or is it so unappealing that some of the top pros, both men and women, decide not to show up, and they have to turn around and get to play when's Paris not too long after?
It would be 2 weeks after the U.S. Open, which the French Open,
which is almost the full quarantine time, right? Like, I mean, like if you leave the States, are you allowed to fly to Paris directly? You know, there is those concerns at that time, so we'll see how the top players react to putting their schedule together.
Right. And the juxtaposition of the U.S. Open and the U.S. Open just trying to get off the ground and running without fans. The French Open is selling tickets, and they're trying to get close to 60% of their fan base in. And, you know, in New York, again, there will be holes in that bubble. Like I should correct myself. There is a hotel by JFK. It's brand new. It's got a really big fitness center. And The tour will pay for your one room. If you want a second room, it's on you. And they're also allowing you, if you want, to get a house, but you would have to pay for that. And they will set you up with a real estate agent who I'm sure is not cheap because you're getting something in the Hamptons or whatever. But those are all things that we hope that we're talking about in late August. We hope that we're talking about hockey being played on August 1st. And joining us now on the Maple Toyota Hotline is Bob McKenzie. Bob, how are you?
Excellent. How are you guys doing today?
We're good. We got talking about the U.S. Open because, well, you mentioned the U.S. Open and insider trading. The tennis and hockey, I know it, you've enjoyed going to the U.S. Open, and you tied in the proposed schedule of this Stanley Cup playoff to what it's like at the U.S. Open and staying up all night and into the early morning for matches, or in this case, for games in the NHL.
Yeah, pandemic rules for the NHL, which is to say there are none. And if you're going to set up a system that still maintains the integrity of unlimited overtime to settle games, then that means you do have the possibility of starting games really late, or in a worst-case scenario, I imagine, you know, you could conceivably end up with, you know, you schedule three games in a day, maybe you only get two in. I mean, it would be really like lottery balls coming out the wrong way for you if the first game of the day went to triple or quadruple overtime, and the second game of the day went to triple or quadruple overtime, and you're like, we can't start this thing, you know, that late for the third game of the day, so you may have to, you know, rejig your schedule. And I think everything we talk about with regards to this return to play, it comes with the ultimate flexibility, asterisks, provisos, qualifiers, whatever. It's kind of, you know, a little bit of seat of the pants, in spite of all the efforts that go in to make it as organized and as efficient as possible.
Bob, you mentioned three games a day. It sounds like noon, four and eight at local time, both in Edmonton and Toronto. One thing we don't hardly ever see anymore is games on back-to-back days. With no travel in between and some concerns about scheduling, do you anticipate games series going back-to-back?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think we'll see back-to-back games. And again, there's no hard and fast rule from what I understand, but I think you're going to see the general rule of thumb on these games is it's going to be two games every 3 days, I would think. But there are going to be times, especially once you get by the best of five preliminary round, the best of sevens are still, from what I understand, by the time it's all said and done, if a series is going seven games, it's still going to push pretty close to the 2 week mark. You know, not exactly, but you know, that's even with travel, it sometimes came out right at 2 weeks or a shade over sometimes, depending on arena availability, which they don't have to worry about anymore because obviously the rink's designated for all these games. So, yeah, I think it'll be but definitely back-to-back scenarios, which makes it a little more interesting for how you deploy your goaltenders, given the way hockey has changed over the years on feelings of back-to-back. But I think a lot of those things will kind of go out the window, and you'll just be looking to win. And if you have to play your number one goalie on back-to-back days in the playoffs, where it's a matter of play on or not, you're probably going to ride your big guys as hard as you can for as long as you can.
Joined by our hockey insider, Bob McKenzie, and some of the details that have come out, and Frank Saravalli did such a great job outlining everything on TSN.ca, is that each team is allowed 52 players in the bubble. How are teams reacting to that number?
Well, obviously, you know, they know it needs to be limited. You know, our team's concerned that they don't have enough of this or that in terms of people they can bring to the bubble. You know, think about it for a minute. You know, you're an assistant general manager of a National Hockey League team, and now you're going into these playoffs in the bubble, and in most cases, the GMs are going to their assistant GMs and saying, sorry, no room for you in the bubble. You know, if you can't sanitize the dressing room or do laundry or carry equipment, you'll have to watch the games on TV. And in fact, to that point, you know, the rules are 52 members in the traveling party, including a maximum of 31 players. I know there are some teams that are debating how many players they want to bring. They think 31 is probably on the high side. Mm-hmm. The two big decisions player-wise that people need to make are we bringing three goalies or are we bringing four goalies? That's going to be a big decision. And the second one is going to be how many skaters are we going to have? And there are a number of teams, I know, that are some anyways, that are looking at it and saying, you know what, I don't know if I need a ninth or tenth defenseman or a 15th mm-hmm. or 16th forward as much as I need an extra guy, an extra equipment manager, or an extra medical personnel guy. And the way it was put to me by one general manager is, well, you can max out on your players if you want, but the odds of being using that, 30th and 31st player versus bringing along two guys that could ensure the first, the 10 or 15 most important guys in your team are getting the kind of treatment, medical treatment, massage, ART, whatever the case may be, that, makes them feel comfortable and able to play as much hockey as they're going to play in a short period of time. So teams are trying to figure out how best to strategize and allocate those slots in the 52-man traveling party, or 52-person traveling party.
Bob, one other part of talking about eligibility and who's going to be playing, who's going to be around, that was of note was the idea that independent doctors along with the team doctors could potentially eliminate players from eligibility if those players had underlying health conditions that might make it more difficult if they were to happen to acquire the virus. So just fleshing that out, that is completely out of the player's hands. If I know Max Domi is often cited as a guy who has diabetes, Capococco, whatever it might be. If they say, Max, you're out, there's nothing he can do about it. Get a second opinion, but if the other doctor right. agrees, like, that's it. He's done. He can't sign a waiver. It is out of his hands.
That's correct. And so it is, I should point out both sides of that, but you outlined it correctly, Mike, perfectly, actually. But there is a clause in the return to play that basically says, hey, listen, if you are a higher risk individual who has underlying medical conditions where if you contracted the virus, it could cause much, greater complications and more serious illness than it otherwise might, we have the right to say you're not fit to play. Mm-hmm. And that determination gets made right at the beginning of training camp on Monday. So all these players have to come in and get these pre-camp, assessment, medical assessment done. And so you mentioned Max Domi, as I did in insider trading, and Capococco with the New York Rangers. So Max Domi is a type 1 diabetic. He's also got celiac disease. Capococco is a type 1 diabetic, and he's also got celiac disease. So these are players that have autoimmune sensitivities that are greater than the average player. I'm not suggesting, and I'm sure you weren't suggesting, Mike, that the doctors are going to say, well, if you've got type 1 diabetes and celiac disease, you can't play. Mm-hmm. But the point is, if you have type 1 diabetes and have celiac disease, they are going to probably do a much drill down even more thoroughly than they would if you just showed up and you don't have any underlying conditions. And then the determination needs to be made. And so, my gut tells me that most club doctors or the I don't know if it's the terminology for the, I saw it in the thing, but anyways, the specialist.
The epidemiologist of whatever it's on staff, yes.
Right. And so those club doctors, I think more likely than not, as long as Max and Capococco and some of the other players who have these types of conditions, as long as they're healthy and feeling really good, my guess is that they're more likely than not to get the green light to play. And my understanding, to the best of my knowledge, is that both Capococco and Max Domi, because they're cited so often, it is their desire to play, they want to play, mm-hmm. and their intent to play. But they also know that there is a clause in there that specifically applies to players who have underlying conditions, and they do. So they've got to go through that extra level of screening, and that determination will be made fairly quickly. And whatever the ruling is, as you said, that's the ruling pending going out and getting an independent second medical opinion from somebody else. So that's all agreed to between the NHL and the NHLPA.
Bob McKenzie joining us on Overdrive. And on the CBA side of things, you know, one of the big wins for players is going to the Olympics, and it's a big win for fans. But once this deal is ratified, if it's ratified this week, but I know it's pointing in that direction, there is still work to be done when it comes to the Olympics, is there not? And
yes.
You know, the history tells me that nothing is a sure bet when it comes to the NHL and the IOC or the IIHF getting into a room and agreeing on things.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And, you know, and I think now that it's in the CBA that the owners and the league are going to go, it's as if the NHL and the NHLPA have already locked arms on that, so that when they sit down to talk to the IOC, there's a certain threshold that needs to be met in terms of the costs and the sponsorship things and just the way the players are treated, the way the traveling parties are treated, the accommodations, all of that thing, you know, their family situation, tickets, access, you know, trademarks and everything that goes with it. So, you know, assuming they get that positive reaction from the IOC, then yeah, the deal will be done. But if they don't get that positive reaction from the IOC, then it's the NHL and the NHLPA who will be rejecting it, not just the NHL unilaterally saying, yeah, we don't like the way the IOC is handling this. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas in the past, the players could conceivably say, well, yeah, we're ready to go. That's a good deal. We'll take that. And the owners could say, no, we don't think it is, and we're not going to. Now, I think it's more along the lines of they have a reasonable expectation of what they need from the IOC, and whether it's specifically spelled out or not, you know, they're at least on the same page now, NHL and NHLPA, with regards to what it would take to get a deal with the IOC. And if the IOC offers it, then we're going. And if the IOC doesn't offer it, then we're not.
Bob, you know how much I love the numbers. So I'm looking at the CBA and the flat cap and what that, you know, because the idea that the players did actually pretty well here to kind of smooth out some of their escrow payments. And there is a give and take to everything. But I start extrapolating out, a $90 million cap is about $300 million more per year to the players than an $80 million cap. On and on we go. And the cap's basically going to stay the same until the NHL gets back to this year's projected revenues, roughly of $4.8 billion.
Yep.
What do you think is a realistic goal for the industry of the NHL as a timeline to get back to that number? I mean, obviously, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen with fans in the stands. But let's assume at some point next year, fans will be allowed. Are we talking 2 years, 3 years, 5 years before they get back to that number? And then they can kind of delink the 81.5 and maybe have that cap pushing up again?
Unlike you, MJ, I did not take economics and or business at a fine institution like Bowling Green State University. So you probably have a better answer. As you asked that question, you could probably answer it better than I could. But, you know, let's not gild the lily here. This is a disastrous economic situation for the National Hockey League, in large part because as much as they lost by not being able to complete 2019-20 with fans in the stands as they normally would, and this return to play really just kind of salvages some television monies, really, at the end of the day, not insignificant sums, otherwise they wouldn't be doing it. But, I mean, we don't even know on January 1 if the NHL season is going to start on January 1. And if it is it 100% capacity? I seriously doubt it. Mm-hmm. That'd be my guess. Is it 50? Is it 25? Is it none? You know, how? And for every month of the 20-21 season where there's no fans or just a portion of the fans in the stands, the hole gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And how long does that go on for? You know, is it conceivable that next season could come and go and you're just at a you know, an infinitesimally small fraction of the revenue you were kind of projecting. And so it's a moving target. But, the CBA extension, as you know, MJ, just gives them so much more runway to pay down the debt for both sides. And they desperately need that, because if they didn't have it and they were just working with the next two seasons on the existing CBA,
can't even contemplate those numbers.
The players would be literally playing for pennies on the dollar. Mm-hmm. And the owners would be, you know, faced with a corrective salary cap that would be almost unmanageable for most teams. You know, mm-hmm. 60 or 65 million. And so it's just, you know, they need that extra time. So I got to, but you know what? They've got a US TV deal coming online here. They got Seattle coming on, which, even though the expansion monies don't go directly to the bottom line for HRR, the fact that, you know, Seattle is going to come in and generate revenue, you know, ticket sales, hats, jerseys, the whole nine yards, all of that, you know, that's going to help the picture. And I think there's a relative optimism that if we can get by the virus and, it, you know, get a vaccine and just get full houses again, that the NHL is well positioned to rebound very quickly. But we just don't know how long that that period of time is going to be, they don't know how many people are going to be in the stands.
And that still is the plan for next season, right? Like, they are adamant that they want 82 games, but they want game one to have fans in the stands still, right?
That's the plan, and that's the hope. But, mm-hmm. you know, and again, is it, how many is it going to be? And, mm-hmm. and so you're right. I mean, you know, it's going to be interesting times. This is, I can tell you this, I've got to assume the economic impact is going to be minimum 3 or 4 years. Just got to figure that.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I think even from a scheduling point of view and everything else, so if we do start next season, fans or no fans or part fans, on January 1, we got to be still playing the Stanley Cup Final in July sometime. There's no way around it with an 82-game schedule. And you got to probably get it done before the third week of July, because that's when the Olympics, Summer Olympics, are going to be next year, the ones that were postponed this year. NBC's a rights holder for the Olympics. They can't do the Cup Final up against the Olympics in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And so now you're into mid-July next summer. And that means you're not starting on October 1st as per normal. So now if you're starting the following season at in November or December, and you've got to go to the Olympics that season, so you got to shut your season down for 3 weeks, you're back to, I think you're back to July hockey again. And that's two full years out. And so, the whole way we think about the game in terms of our psyche as to, you know, when hockey starts and when it ends, the financial aspects of it. Oh, you know, players are really wealthy. They make lots of money. Sure they do, but they're not going to get nearly as much, you know, and I know some players who are probably looking at it, and they're, you know, they're 30, 31 years old. They've got a year or two left on their deal, and they're thinking to themselves, so they make $4 or $5 million, but then they're looking at 20% escrow, a 10% deferral, of which I'll get back. But looking at that, and we don't know, down could be a couple of years of that. Then what am I going to sign for? Is there no money in the system? If I'm making $4 or $5 million now, might I only be making $1 million the year after that? And if I am, how much is, what's the escrow going to be on that? So it's going to completely and dramatically impact everybody involved in the game from a business point of view, that's for sure.
Yeah, those are the guys I'd be worried about when we finally get to those points, free agency and everything else. Those mid-range guys, it's going to be a sticky situation with a tight cap. But for us to get there, Bob, maybe just lay out the timeline. The owners, when do they vote? The player reps, I think the 31 guys, they need to vote on it. If it passes with them, then it goes to the full membership. When does that happen?
Well, the executive board for the NHLPA, with the player reps and what have you, they're They're in the process of doing that vote right now. I would take a wild stab that before the day is out, that this will get officially forwarded to the full membership for a vote. I'd be really surprised if it didn't, but nevertheless. And that vote could begin as early as tomorrow. And it could take till Friday to get everything tallied and done. And
I think is it just a simple majority, Bob? Is it just like 50 plus one?
Unless they decide to change something, okay. I know all along the plan has been, the two things that I was told is that if the full membership's voting on it, the two things are, number one, simple majority, and number two, you have to vote on the whole enchilada. It's the return to play phase three, the return to play phase four, the CBA extension, memorandum of understanding, the transition rules, and the critical dates calendar. The whole enchilada, it's either accept or reject, and simple majority carries the day. Now, I suppose it's possible, I'm not expecting it, but it's possible that the executive board could, you know, attach some conditions to, you know, what the vote is or should be or whatever, but I think the bylaws pretty much specify simple majority on that stuff. As far as the Board of Governors go, it's a lot easier to throw a conference call together, and the expectation is that they, too, will be ready to ratify or not and have their vote no later than Friday. So I think by close of business Friday or thereabouts, the likelihood that we know if it's been ratified by both parties, and then we're opening up camps on Monday.
So what you're telling me is your Twitter feed might dictate this show for the entire week, which began yesterday with your breaking news almost 24 hours ago.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm just trying to, I'm hoping to try and nail it all down early enough on Friday that it doesn't ruin my dinner plans that I got ruined last Friday and what have you. So, and plus I'm planning on, I'm taking the veteran, extreme veteran option of not covering training camp. So training camps are starting Monday and I'm going on vacation Saturday. And when the games come back on August 1st, assuming the games come back, that's when I'll be back to do a little bit of work. We'll see beyond that.
Power veteran that move, Bob. But more importantly, as of yesterday, did you hit the island green at 17 at Wood 6 in one?
No, I didn't. I didn't hit it at all. I didn't hit it with all three shots that I took. Because it wasn't very crowded at Wooden Sticks. And my son, who's become quite a good golfer, he took, I think, three or four shots. We were just horsing around, and he only put one in the drink and landed three on the green. I took three shots and landed all three in the drink, although I have on two occasions hit it. One time I hit it really well and put it right in the center of the green, which is really unusual. Never happens on any par three for me. And the other one was a beautiful one of those ones where you sky it with like a nine iron, and it was so high. It was, and I thought, there's no way it's making it across. And it came down, it went so high, almost straight up and straight down, but it landed, you know, the logs that they use to obviously keep the whole thing?
Yeah.
It landed directly on top of the foremost, the front log of the green, and I was waiting breathlessly as it bounced about another 30 feet in the air to see which way it was, whether it was going to bounce back or forward, and it landed just inside. And so, anyways, we'll give that one another go next week.
And these are more of the stories we're expecting from you once hockey and the world allows you to actually semi-retire. We'll call it a semi-retirement.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Sounds good. But, you know, the big, just from a business point of view, like final comment, the biggest challenge here, talking about games on August 1st and the whole return to play and trying to award the Stanley Cup, is this the beginning of next week is so important, because you're getting literally hundreds, you know, almost 47% of the league has to report to phase two or phase three over the course of this week and Monday. And there's massive amounts of testing for those guys that's going to come. How many of them are going to test positive? And over the course of training camp, and we're seeing this with the MLS teams that are getting, you know, blasted with 7-8 positive tests on a team and having to pull out of games and that Getting from here to August 1st is the challenge. And I really feel like, and I could be wrong on this, it's just an opinion, I really feel like if the NHL can get the 24 teams to the hub cities and be in reasonably good shape with their numbers on August 1st, that they've got a plan that has a chance to be successful over the next 2 or 3 months that would result in a cup being presented. But I think the real danger zone is between now and July 26th when the teams are reporting to the hub.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we keep saying if we're talking about a hockey game being played, we know that they've overcome a huge obstacle. So let's hope that we get to that stage. And Bob, great work tracking all of this. We're glad that you got your golf game in yesterday, and hopefully you have more news for us sooner rather than later so you can enjoy the end of your week. Thanks for doing this.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, MJ. Have a good one.
Bob McKenzie joining us on the Maple Toyota Hotline. The showroom is open. They're taking the necessary steps to provide a safe environment for every guest. Visit Maple Toyota next to Wonderland or buy online at mapletoyota.com. And all those tests that are going to happen over the next week or so.
That's it.
And there's going to be positive tests. And it's going to cause people to say, shut it down. We can't do this. I would assume that the league and the PA are prepared for those positive numbers. It's just a matter of how you handle them and how do you move forward with those numbers and keeping everyone safe.
Because the guys in camp won't be in the bubble. They will be in their life. And so what I'm hopeful of is that we've seen, whether it's Tampa shut their facility, St. Louis have a handful of guys test positive, the Leafs have had guys test positive.
Right.
That has kind of snapped guys to attention, and now guys know, even though they don't actually get to the bubble city till the 26th of July or whatever it is, now's the time to start really being careful and about how you and your family are living your life, because there's no point in going through all of this and all the sacrifices that everyone's going to have to go through to try to get this done and then have it unravel because you wanted to go to the patio, to the restaurant, to the beach, to the bar, to the gym, whatever it might be, wherever you are. And I think now's the time, though, because try to get under control now as people testing positive next week when they get here, or when they get to camp and start their camp, then while they're going through their camp in their home cities, really lock it down. If you test negative the first day, awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Live your life like it is everything in you to stay negative and never test positive, and then get yourself to the bubble city. I think it's really important. Bob laid it out beautifully that kind of this weekend on into through next week and how the guys behave while in training camp, because there won't be that many restrictions on what they're allowed to do after their practices. They can go do whatever they want, live their life normally.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the teams will be asking them not to make sure that they give themselves their best chance to be successful when they finally do get to Edmonton and Toronto.
So we all have a general idea of what the NHL is trying to accomplish and how they'll get to August 1st. The NFL, we're still trying to figure that one
out. Yes.
And it's funny, they have runway, and I feel like they're really using that. But eventually they're going to have to start making some decisions.
Right.
And I bring up decisions because the Chiefs made a decision to throw $500 million at Patrick Mahomes. He is the richest athlete in league sports in North America.
We'll get into the semantics of that.
Yeah, we got to get into the semantics. As you pointed out, you love numbers, so we'll get to that. And I'm also, we're going to discuss, because Mahomes is so young and he's already accomplished, and it's kind of like, well, you throw all the money you want because he's so good. Which young athlete do you think will be the most successful over the next decade? That and much more as Overdrive continues on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and also on TSN 4. Overdrive continues on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and also on TSN 4. Mark Rowe in for Brian Hayes this week, joined alongside Mike Johnson. Marcellus Wiley's going to join us at 6:05. I got a feeling that Patrick Mahomes will come up in conversation with him, because Patrick Mahomes is a very rich man after yesterday's news, and we alluded to it because, you know, the NFL is unique in the sense that it's not all guaranteed money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can bet that Patrick Mahomes will hit most, if not all, of his incentives. Yep. If he is able to do that, it is $502.63 million over the next 12 years. The base value of his contract, including the next two seasons before the extension kicks in, it all averages out to $45 million per year. Now, the guarantee is $141 million, which for any, like, hey, I'll take it, $141 million.
That'll do.
But when you're talking about the Mike Trouts in the world and who is guaranteed this money.
Garrett Cole, the baseball guaranteed money.
We have to allow Patrick Mahomes to play out his contract before we announce really that he is the richest man in American team sports. Either way, congratulations, Patrick Mahomes, and congratulations to your agents and to your family, and really to the Chiefs who are trying to repeat as champs. And because it's an extension, he's like $5 million against the cap this year. So the Chiefs have a really good chance at repeating here.
They do, and this will be the fascinating part, and we'll check in with Marcellus in the 6 o'clock hour who will maybe give us some insight on it. But how you build your team, especially in the next few years, not next this year, I think his salary cap is quite low. Next year, it's also not that high. It's in the 20s before it gets right up there near 50. But how are you going to build your team 3 years from now, 4 years from now?
Yeah.
I know the cap will continue to go up, and it won't eat the same high percentage, but that's when it gets interesting and how that dynamic plays itself out. They put themselves in a great spot for the next couple of years. After that, we will see. And after that, we probably will get a greater sense of how spectacularly incredible Patrick Mahomes is, because he probably won't have the same amount of quality around him just because there's not enough dollars to go around. So, it's amazing. And 10 years in football seems ludicrous, although he's a quarterback, and it's likely that he'll be able to stay healthy because that's such a violent sport. But I would not call it currently the highest contract.
You're all about the details.
Because it's about the guaranteed money. I mean, you hear a whole bunch. Now, his is higher than most, but you hear a whole bunch of guys, oh, $120 million contract, that's $35 million guarantee. Mm-hmm. And how many of those guys get the full 120? Almost none of them. Whether it's a restructuring or they just walk away or an injury, whatever it is. So I hope none of that happens. I hope he makes the full 520, whatever it is. But I think the baseball players right now have it more locked in than he does. But it's really something. And how that reverberates around the league, Dak Prescott comes to mind. You know, what happens with his contract negotiations. And also, and this is what I want to know about Marcellus, because I know how it works in hockey a little bit. I played a few years under the salary cap rules. You know, what's the dynamic like in the room? Everyone's happy for you, obviously. You're a good guy, your teammates, you want everyone to do well. But at some point, there's only so much to go around. And every dollar that you take is then for a dollar that is not available for the rest of the team. And I wonder if there's ever somebody saying, when is enough enough? If the salary caps, it was $180 million, do you need to take a quarter of it? Could 40 be enough? Could 37 be enough? Because the guy who's the second string middle linebacker doesn't want to play for the league minimum. He'd like to make $1.5 million, not 500.
Right.
So I wonder what the dynamic is like in a locker room when one guy will eat up so much in a team where even being a great individual player like Patrick Mahomes is, you still can't win without a good team around you.
Yeah, it's so tough to win in the league. It's kind of the same as the NHL in a way that we talk about your superstars and getting production from them when they're on that entry-level deal.
Right.
And how scary that is for the Maple Leafs, because they didn't win when Matthews and Marner and Nylander were on those entry-level deals. And you know, you always want to make the comparison to the Blackhawks. Well, the Blackhawks did really well with Taves and Kane on their entry and that kind of bridge deal before.
Well, that was the thing, right? Their bridge was palatable.
Yes. It was, I want to say, in the 5 range, and then they hit the double digits, and they've never won a playoff series since that was activated. You know, the Chiefs at least can say, well, we've won already. You know, and we want to win again, of course, but we've at least won already, and we got a good chance at winning next year. Now, in 2027, when his cap hit is $59.95 million, that's someone else's problem, right? Probably.
Right.
And whatever. At least we know that we'll have a good quarterback. But, you know, kind of Tom Brady and the Patriots aside, look at teams and how they've tried to manage the salary cap with their quarterbacks. And
well,
it's tricky.
It. Tom Brady's Tom Brady's maybe the perfect example. Like, why New England was able to stay competitive for so long is because he didn't. Yeah. He left $10 million a year on the table to try to build around him. So I'm not calling Patrick Mahomes greedy. I am always for every player getting every cent they possibly can. They don't have to apologize to anybody for anything, not their fans, not their teammates, not anybody.
Right.
But I am curious to see what the reaction will be. Obviously, happiness, but when you go to get a next contract and you're like, can we restructure yours because Patrick's getting 55? Can you go from 3 to 2? That might leave a sour taste in some guys' mouths.
And a lot of people are making the argument, if there is a sure bet in the NFL, it's Patrick Mahomes at the age of 24, given what he's already done, what he will do for the Chiefs. And it got us thinking, you know, who can you bank on for the next 10 years? We'll discuss that when Overdrive continues on TSN 4, TSN 1050, and also the TSN app. Overdrive on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and on TSN 4. Marcellus Wiley will join us at 6:05, and also Ryan Rashog, our TSN Edmonton reporter, at 6:25. We were talking about Patrick Mahomes and the $500 million that he could make if he hit all those incentives. Of course, the guaranteed money, just over $140 million, but also got us thinking about top young athletes over the next 10 years and who you can, I know, pardon the pun, bank on. Some names that come to mind: Zion Williamson, Connor McDavid, Alphonso Davies, Lamar Jackson, Bianca Andreescu. Mike, who comes to mind outside of Patrick Mahomes that you think in 10 years from now they're going to have a pretty good decade?
I got a few people that come to mind right away. One, Zion, because basketball is the most individual of the team sports, so that if you're great individually, you package another guy around him, and he might be good enough that guys want to play with him specifically, or he could change teams like they do often in the NBA and pair up with someone. That alone will ensure that he'll be successful. Massive financial gains in the NBA, so I think Zion's going to be in for a pretty nice ride for the next decade. That's an obvious one. Maybe not so obvious. Alphonso Davies. So you have to be one of the best in the world. Okay, well, he's already considered that at left back. And you also need a chance to win. And he's at Bayern right now. Obviously, one of the powerhouse clubs in all of European football. He'll always seemingly win their domestic league, but they'll be in Champions League. They'll be in the running for all the big trophies every year. And if he gets transferred probably to a Premiership team, it's going to be Man City, one of the top teams anyways over there. Again, he'll make a ton of money, and he will be almost guaranteed to compete for championships every single year because teams won't spend that much money on a left back unless you're one of the best teams and biggest teams in the world. So I think Alphonso Davies is up for a pleasant decade financially, but also almost more guaranteed team success than any of them. And the other one that came to mind for me, I think Bianca Andreescu. Individual sport, she's so young. If she can stay healthy, and I'm assuming that she will, there looks like there is going to be some sort of void at the top of women's tennis, and there will be a spot to be taken. And I think she's already shown in the previous 18 months that she is capable of filling it, not only with her game, but maybe more importantly, with her personality, with her grit, with her ability to rise to the big moments, which hasn't always been the case over the last decade or so for women's tennis. So I think for her, and women's tennis might be the most financially lucrative of all the women's sports, and it's an individual thing, so she doesn't have to count on anyone else other than herself. An opportunity will be there for her to win. Serena Williams will retire at some point, unless she's playing doubles with her daughter. You can check the pictures; it's pretty cute. But I think Bianca Andreescu has a chance to have a great run, provided she maintains good health.
Such an opportunity in women's tennis right now, and we keep waiting for someone to kind of, like, Naomi Osaka won back-to-back Grand Slams, and there's still questions about whether or not she can be that dominating player. Not that she's good enough, it's just there's so many inconsistencies. The injuries are going to be what stands in the way of Bianca Andreescu, but her mental strength, the way that she battles, the style of play, like, you can, all you had to do is watch what she did
last year. She's charismatic too. Like, you want to root for her, not just because she's Canadian. I get that. But I think you see, even saw how the American fans and around the world have embraced her, except when they're playing, when she's playing Serena maybe, but they embraced, kind of the youthful swagger that she brings to the court and that kind of fearless nature she has. And you're right, a huge, huge opportunity for someone to fill, and I think she has as good a chance as anyone.
And not that injuries don't happen in soccer, but Alphonso Davies, I would, you know, he will more likely be healthy over the next 10 years than, say, a Connor McDavid. And being Canada's superstar, the opportunities that he'll have on both sides of the ocean, I love what's going to happen, and we'll love what he's already been doing as a 19-year-old. So there you have it, our top young athletes to bank on. We'll discuss Patrick Mahomes and taking that money to the bank with Marcellus Wiley when we return on Overdrive on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and also on TSN 4.